Please call the case.
Case numbers SCWC-28314, ON versus Liberty Mutual Fire Insurance Company, and SCWC-28315, Kim versus Liberty Mutual Fire Insurance Company. Arguing for petitioner, Liberty Mutual Fire Insurance Company, James Monla. Arguing for respondent, DCCA Insurance Commissioner, Elmira Sang. Arguing for respondents, ON and Kim, Melvin Agena. Argument on the merits.
Thank you. Counsel, I want to make sure that I have the scheduling correct. According to an email I received, or I got a copy of an email, the first to argue will be Mr. Monma, and he has 20 minutes, then Ms. Sang for 5 minutes, Mr. Agena for 25, and Mr. Monma again for 10 minutes. Does that accurately reflect your agreement?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Mr. Monma, you may proceed.
Thank you very much.
Honorable members of the court, thank you this morning for the opportunity to present oral arguments on these particular cases. I am appearing on behalf of both cases of Chung Mi-an and Ki-sun Kim. Very briefly, in terms of the background of the cases, they're very similar with respect to both claimants. Both claimants were involved in a motor vehicle accident. The vehicles in which the claimants occupied at the time of the accident, each accident, was insured under a motor vehicle insurance policy issued through Liberty Mutual Fire Insurance Company. After the accident, each claimant received medical treatment and or health care treatment, and which billed Liberty Mutual. Liberty Mutual thereafter paid the bills for the claimant's treatment and or services that they received after each respective accident. At some point in time, Liberty Mutual obtained a records review for both claimants' cases. The records review was a basis for the issuance of two specific denials issued to each respective claimant for specific treatment that each claimant had received during the course of their treatment. After the denials were issued, each claimant requested a review before the Hawaii Insurance Commissioner. A motion for summary judgment was heard before the Insurance Commissioner on the issue of whether or not each claimant was the real party in interest to pursue the administrative action against Liberty Mutual. The Insurance Commissioner agreed that the claimants were not the real party in interest to pursue the action against Liberty Mutual. The claimants appealed the Insurance Commissioner's final order to the Circuit Court. The Circuit Court reversed the Insurance Commissioner's final order, finding that Act 198, which amended in part Hawaii Revised Statute Section 431-10C-308.5E, conferred upon each claimant the status of real party in interest. As part of the analysis by the Circuit Court relied upon the legislative history to Act 198, which stated in part that the claimant should be recognized as a real party in interest to pursue or to submit to the Insurance Commissioner, to arbitration, or court of competent jurisdiction any dispute between an insurance carrier and a provider as far as with regards to any fee, the amount of a charge, or the procedural code used. And this is what is set forth in Hawaii Revised Statute Section 431-10C-308.5E. The Circuit Court final judgment was appealed by Liberty Mutual to the Intermediate Court of Appeals.
Mr. Monma.
Yes, Justice Acoba.
Is Act 198 retroactive?
I have taken the position that it is, in the sense that Act 198 provided a remedial measure for the claimants to pursue a fee dispute.
And so is your position that Act 198 in effect wipes out all that prior case law? Being Gamata, Wilson, and Dakane.
It's retroactive, but it does not, it is the position of Liberty Mutual that Act 198, which amended Section 431-10C-308.5E, is retroactive as to those cases, but does not overrule those cases.
Why is it your position that it's retroactive? I would think your position would be it's not retroactive.
The way I read the statutory provision, and the way I read the, in particular, the real party and interest provision, is I look at it, in my own view, Justice Okoba, that it is a remedial measure for the claimants to pursue a fee dispute between the insurance carrier and the provider. In other words, it doesn't confer, because The amendment doesn't confer upon the claimant any additional rights, but just gives them a means by which to enforce that right with respect to a fee dispute. And when I say a fee dispute, Mr. Cooper, pardon me, I'm using that term very generically, as the legislature has done. When I say a fee dispute, I'm speaking of a dispute between the insurance carrier and the provider over a dispute over a fee, amount of a charge, or the procedural code used.
Mr. Monroe, if I might interrupt you one moment.
Yes, Justice.
Wouldn't it have been inconsistent and maybe even contrary to common sense for the legislature to have intended that the claimant could challenge a fee dispute, either the amount or perhaps a the procedural code for a treatment, and yet not be able to challenge a complete denial of a payment for treatment?
At first blush, that would seem to be what the legislature was intending, but I disagree with that in the sense that the way I read the legislative history for Act 198, it is to allow the claimant to pursue a fee dispute, as I use it generically, in order to ensure proper payment to a provider. And supposedly, from this proper payment to a provider, there's this benefits that the claimant would receive, which is the benefit of having the relationship, maintaining the relationship with their physician, to ensure this pool of physicians to provide benefits or treatment to no-fault insurers, which the legislature found that doctors, because of this of denials, were not treating patients. But I don't think that's consistent, because with respect to the language of the legislative history itself, it appears to me that the legislature did recognize the difference between a fee dispute and a treatment denial, and in fact it did distinguish it within the body in and of itself.
But wasn't that with respect to the issue, the problems that the legislature thought were caused by the this court's decision in the Orthopedic Associates case?
Correct.
The triplicate?
Yes, Justice McKinnon, forgive me for interrupting. Yes, it was, in essence, the court was distinguishing it, that they say that treatment denials are different from fee disputes and that fee disputes don't require a denial. But what I recognize in that particular sentence that the legislature had in their history is that they did distinguish, or they did recognize there is a difference between the two. And within the course of the legislative history, the legislature only indicated that the claimant may be a real party in interest with respect to fee dispute. They recognize that there are treatment denials. If the legislature intended the claimant to also be a real party in interest with respect to treatment denials, as you mentioned, Justice Duffy, the legislature could have said that fee disputes and treatment denials, but they limited the language to the legislative history to specifically treatment denials. And in fact, the statutory provision under 431.10c.308.5e only indicates that the claimant can submit a dispute with respect to a fee, amount of charge, or a procedural code. It would have been much clearer if the legislature, in this case, amended, say, the administrative hearing provision, which is 431.10c.212.
But doesn't 212 clearly state on, by its own terms, that the claimant can actually pursue an administrative hearing? It already says that.
That's correct.
And actually, doesn't the legislative history state that the legislature's concern was to clarify the intent and referred specifically to Wilson? And wasn't Wilson a complete denial case?
That is correct. The only way that it can be reconciled, Justice McKenna, in my mind, is I believe the Wilson decision is still correct. And the Wilson decision, and also the other cases of Geico versus Hyman, the court found that the insured or the claimant is under the no-fault statutory scheme is only entitled to receive appropriate and reasonable treatment. That is, the provider is the party to receive payment of the benefits that is providing for the services. The Wilson decision is still correct in my mind, in the sense that this particular amendment to 431.10c.308.5e was simply recognized, perhaps as an exception to the Wilson decision, that the claimant should be allowed, in the instance of a fee dispute, to pursue the proper payment on behalf of the provider.
Otherwise, if the concern, however, if the concern is that physicians are refusing to treat auto accident patients, well, that the result of Wilson was that, then how could you, wouldn't not allowing a claimant to pursue a denial have the same problem? Why would internists then want to treat no-fault patients if after the first visit after an auto accident, their no-fault, their claim to the no-fault carrier was denied?
The way I distinguish it in my mind is with respect to a fee dispute, you're really not contesting the type of treatment or the appropriateness of the treatment. The only thing that is an issue is to how much the doctor is going to get. On a treatment denial, you're not even reaching the question as to how much the doctor is going to get. And in essence, the legislative intent may never be realized by allowing the claimant to contest a treatment denial. As an example, Justice McKenna, if the treatment is deemed to be inappropriate and unreasonable, and that is the basis for the denial, as in these particular cases, the issue as to whether or not that the treatment being reasonable and appropriate, if it's found to be unreasonable and inappropriate, you would never reach the question as to whether or not what is the proper payment to the provider, because the provider will never receive payment. Therefore, the legislative intent with regard to the provider being paid will never be realized in that instance, because the provider will never be paid. And therefore, the claimant could never pursue the proper payment, because there would be no proper payment owing to the provider. And the statute under 431.10(c)(103.5) indicates that the insurance carrier is to pay only for appropriate, reasonable, and necessary medical treatment to the claimant.
Mr. Mama, if 308.5 precludes the plaintiff from contesting the denial of benefits, and it's limited only to, as you said, the amount of the billing, then where does the claimant go? What part of the statute does the claimant go to in order to assert the denial of a claim of benefits?
I'm not sure I follow your question, Justice Scobo.
Well, you're saying that under Act 198, the plaintiff or claimant cannot file a motion to or file a claim against a denial of benefits.
Correct.
I'm asking you, where then does a claimant go to file or object to a denial of claim of benefits by the insurer?
I think under Wilson versus AIG, that controls it. If the claimant is a real party in interest, such as the claimant asserts a right or the denial interferes the right to assert a tort claim.
I guess I'm asking you what statute?
The claimant has the option under 431.10(c)(212) to request an administrative hearing.
So 212 would be the basis for a claimant asserting an objection to a denial of claim of benefits.
That would not be the only statute. That would be one of the statutes. The other statute would be 431.10(c)(213), which is the right to request arbitration or petition the circuit court where the injury occurred for the appointment of an arbitrator.
Okay. Although 212 refers to arbitration.
212. I'm sorry. 212 refers to administrative hearing.
Administrative hearing.
Yes.
Okay. Does it refer to a court proceeding too?
Under 212?
Yes.
Only with respect to the appeal of an insurance commissioner's decision. Then the appeal is directed to
you're correct.
The circuit court. But in terms of the administrative action, it goes through the insurance commissioner. If the request for the administrative review is requested within 60 days of the date of the denial.
Okay.
I hope I addressed the justice's question.
Yes.
The problem that I have with respect to the Intermediate Court of Appeals ruling in this particular case is the use of this particular section 431.10(c)(308.5e) as the statutory provision to confer upon the claimant the status of real party in interest would simply throw other statutory provisions into chaos. And what I mean by that is by implication and by the language of the statute under 431.10(c)(308.5e), an insurance carrier need not issue a denial for that type of dispute. If the authorizing statute to allow any claimant to contest any denial is under 43110C38.5E, then I have to assume then that the provisions within that statutory language also would apply to any dispute of a no-fault of a denial of benefits. That would mean then that the insurance carrier would have to negotiate with the provider with respect to the outstanding claims. And if there is no resolution after a 60-day period, then the claimant, insurer, or the provider can request or submit the dispute to an administrative hearing, arbitration, or court of competent jurisdiction. But the fact remains that the statute clearly provides that no denial be issued. So therefore, the question becomes, if you assume that the legislative intent was to allow 43110C through 8.5E to be used as the authorizing statute to allow any claimant to request an administrative hearing.
Didn't the ICA actually just say that what the legislature did was clarify the intent, its intent that claimants should be allowed to directly pursue these claims despite other statutory language that says that the providers cannot collect from them. So it wasn't necessarily the ICA ruling that the Act 198 overruled that the statute 308, the amendment to the statute is what gives them the right, because you're right, the statute just refers to partial denials, I believe. But what the ICA ruled was that the legislature clarified its intent and said that this court's previous construction of the statutory intent in Wilson was not the legislature's intent.
That is correct, Justice McKenna. And your reading of the ICA's opinion is correct. However, that then goes back to my original argument in the sense that the legislative history that is by which the Intermediate Court of Appeals is citing to is the legislative history to Section 43110C through 8.5E. It is not the legislative history to Section 43110C212. It is not the legislative history to 43110C213.
Well, following up on Justice Acoba's question then, doesn't HRS 43110C314 state right now and is as it did back then, that any person may bring suit for breach of any contractual obligation assumed by an insurer? And so what you're saying is that despite this language, for a direct denial, a insured would not be able to bring a suit for a denial under this statute due to Wilson still being in effect.
Correct. That would be our position.
Okay.
Getting back to your question, Justice McKenna, The concern I have with regard to the opinion by the Intermediate Court of Appeals again is that by ruling that the claimants the claimant in this particular case, and in fact the claimant and Chung Myon, was a real party in interest to pursue an administrative action against Liberty Mutual, by implication, the court is acknowledging that even with respect to a treatment denial, the claimant is a real party in interest. Although the court did recognize that they're not making a decision as to how it should be applied in terms of the scope of their decision. But by holding that the claimant in this particular case was a real party in interest, by implication, and allowing the claimant to go forward with their administrative action, by implication, the court is recognizing the claimant as a real party in interest with respect to that treatment denial, which I believe is an improper expansion of Section 43110C through 8.5E.
Mr. Monma, in Wilson, this court at least recognized that a claimant could be a real party in interest if they're put in jeopardy of reaching the threshold amount to sue. The second thing, reason that this court rejected coming out of the ICA opinion was the idea that this not allowing the claimant to attain a real party in interest status would injure the patient-client relation, patient-doctor relationship, which may be needed in terms of future care. Now, the legislature apparently adopted the ICA's position and rejected the Supreme Court's position in Wilson because they made a finding. I'm just reading from the report, the Legislative Conference Committee report, that patients have a direct interest in proper payment to their doctors to maintain appropriate treatment and patient-doctor relationships. So with that finding and the resulting consequence that doctors are not or reluctant to accept patients who are subject to or involved in automobile accidents, do we have in fact now a finding that the Wilson rejection of that interest is incorrect?
Arguably, yes, but I would qualify my answer to say that arguably, yes, but only within this narrow context of what is determined to be a fee dispute. If you look at that particular portion of the legislative history, Justice Okoba, that you just read, it does refer to the that they have a direct interest in proper payment. Again, a fee dispute is one in which you're not determining whether the treatment in and of itself is appropriate and reasonable. Under a fee dispute situation, you're only determining in terms of how much the doctor should get and how much more the doctor should get.
But that's the only interest. Can you extract that finding out of this report that now it states the court legislature has made a finding that, you know, this is a situation without respect to, you know, payment or denial of benefits. They've made the finding that the patients have a direct interest in proper payment to their doctors to maintain appropriate treatment.
Correct. But again, when you're dealing with a treatment denial, you're not dealing with, and in these particular cases in particular, we're not dealing with a contention that the bill that the provider provided or the procedural code that the provider used or the fee that the provider set forth in their bill was inappropriate. What the heart of the denials go to is the treatment for which the bill gave rise is not appropriate and reasonable. If you continue to look at the legislative history also, Justice Okoba, it does then end that your committee on conference has amended this measure by, and it sets forth the right of the claimant. And it again reiterates that the claimant has a right to submit a dispute concerning a procedural code, a fee, or a charge. Despite what the legislature said, they never incorporated within that body of their measure that the claimant has a right to submit any dispute concerning a denial of benefits.
Well, Mr. Monma,
yes,
what is the logical distinction between the patient or the insured challenging a denial and the patient or insured challenging a fee dispute? Why would the legislature give the real party in interest standing to a patient challenging a fee dispute and not challenging a denial?
In the way I reconcile that particular issue, Judge Chang, is the fact that on a fee dispute situation, you're only dealing with the payment to the doctor. That means that the only amount is the money. On a treatment denial, the issue is more of a appropriateness and reasonableness of the treatment, and therefore we run into, again, the situation with Wilson and also Geico versus Hyman, in that the statutory scheme, or the no-fault statutory scheme, indicates that the claimant only has a right to receive the appropriate and reasonable treatment.
And why did the legislature draw a distinction in your mind?
In the only way I reconcile that, Judge Chang, is to find that the legislature meant to create, perhaps arguably, an exception to Wilson, that in the circumstances where a fee dispute does arise, the claimant should be able to contest it, arguably. But that does not mean that the legislature meant that it should expand to all treatment denials. And again, by applying this particular section to all treatment denials, it really doesn't make sense, because then arguably an insurance carrier would not be obligated to issue a denial. If an insurance carrier is not obligated to issue a denial, then really the 431.10c212 is really not triggered because the claimant or provider can request an administrative hearing within 60 days of the date of a denial. But if there's no denial for which they can request a hearing, then really 431.10c.212 is rendered a nullity.
No, it seems to me, Mr. Mama, that I hear your argument in that, but it seems like denial of payment for a complete treatment is the ultimate fee dispute.
Maybe I might misspeak. In this particular case, it's not a complete treatment denial. It's a treatment denial, but it's only for a particular treatment. And when I look at the distinguishment between what the legislature set forth in their legislative history, I have to imagine that if they really meant to have this particular amendment apply across the board to any particular denial, including fee disputes, that would have been set forth within the history and also within the body of the statutory language itself. But the plain language of the statute simply doesn't recognize that.
Mr. Marmo, how would the requiring the insurance, allowing a plaintiff to have, or the insured standing, real party and interest standing to pursue a treatment denial, how would that be, how do you get from there to the insurer would not be obligated to issue a denial?
Because if 431.10c.308.5e and its legislative history is interpreted to be an enunciation by the legislature that under this particular statutory provision, the claimant is authorized to pursue as a real party in interest any denial, including a fee dispute, then by implication, you would have to follow the constraints of that particular statute as the authorizing statute to give the claimant the right to pursue the action. Under the language of 431.10c.308.5e, it specifically states that insurance carrier, and if you classify this as a dispute now or a fee dispute, need not issue a denial. If you're making a denial to the basis of, well, it's a fee dispute, it's a bill, right? So therefore, a bill is a bill, and therefore it's a fee dispute. If you dwindle it down to that measure, then necessarily, if anything that the carrier disagrees with is a fee dispute, even if it's just the appropriate and reasonableness of the treatment, but by implication under 431.10c.308.5e, the insurance carrier would not be obligated to issue a denial for that fee dispute. I'm afraid I went into my rebuttal. I'm sorry. I hope I answered your question, Chief Justice Dr. Yama. Thank you very much.
Ms. Tseng.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you for taking the time to hear oral argument on this matter. I represent Insurance Commissioner Gordon Ito. Previously, Insurance Commissioner J.P. Schmidt filed a cross appeal in both the Kim and the An matters. However, the current Insurance Commissioner wishes to defer to the discretion of the court in terms of the matters on appeal. We await the court's guidance. We do think, in particular, there needs to be some guidance as should the court decide the claimant has standing and is a real party in interest to challenge denial of PIP benefits, that there be some clarity as to notice requirements for the provider or any participation required by the provider in the administrative hearing level. Thank you.
What in particular are you looking for so far as clarity and guidance?
Should the claimant be allowed to pursue administrative action as to the denial of PIP benefits, should the claimant also be required to provide notice to the medical provider? Clearly, the medical provider has standing to challenge any fee denial. There's also a question, is the provider a necessary party to the administrative action?
Anything else?
Thank you.
Mr. Aguena.
Good morning. I'm Mel Aguena, or Melvin Aguena. I represent the respondents, Kim and Han. As I read the Act 198, the way I understand it, it's in two basic parts. One has to do with what they call the fee dispute, the amount of the fee, which is what Mr. Munma correctly characterized. The second part of it, though, really is the intent of the legislature in response to Wilson granting PIP claimants the substantive right to challenge any PIP denial, whether they made the threshold or not. That's my understanding of the statute and reading the committee report. With all due respect to Mr. Munma, the way his argument breaks down, reasoning-wise, in the context of this statute and the amendment is only directed at the amount of fee as opposed to no fee because the treatment is unnecessary, the committee report would never have mentioned Wilson. And the reason for it is Wilson did not deal with the amount of the fee. Wilson dealt with no fee because the peer review committee decided that Dr. Robinson's surgical procedure was unnecessary. It was too aggressive. So again, if Mr. Munma is correct, why would the committee report even mention Wilson when the amount of the fee was not an issue in Wilson? What was at issue in Wilson was the issue of whether or not Wilson had standing and was the real party in interest to bring the claim. I don't know that this particular legislation actually changes Wilson, and here's why. Given the factual constraints of Wilson, I don't know that the Wilson court had any other alternative except to find that Wilson was not a real party in interest. And in addition to that, she really had no standing. My understanding of the decision and the factual pattern is that Wilson conceded she had no interest in the case, she had no further treatment required, and she was only there to ensure that Dr. Robinson, the surgeon, got paid. That's it. She made that admission. I really don't care about this case except to have Dr. Robinson getting paid. If, in fact, the issue there was this altruistic doctor-patient relationship, I want to make Dr. Robinson happy. I want to be on good terms with him. Your Honors, I can't see that as being a substantive right granted by the legislature. It just makes no sense to me. I would even have to agree with the Wilson decision if, in fact, the objective is to protect and make Dr. Robinson happy. Well, of course that's not a substantive right. The legislature never intended that. What the legislature intended was for these claimants to ensure that they continue with the treatment. Now, down at the level where I work, where you're dealing with doctor-patient relationships and doctor-patient treatments, it's really simple. No pay, no treatment. That's what the legislation is about. If the doctor does not get paid, he will not treat the patient in the future, whether they made the threshold or not.
So what your position is that claimant is a real party in interest insofar as there is a protectable interest in the doctor-patient relationship and in ongoing treatment.
That is correct.
And in order to protect that, that relationship, it's imperative that the doctor get paid for the treatment, otherwise there will not be treatment in the future, and that has a widespread consequence in terms of treatment for all claimants.
In response to your first question, the answer is yes, to continue the treatment of the patient. That part is correct. In the context of this overall legislative objective, you're also correct about that, because if in fact these doctors are not getting paid, and they're not going to take the time to go challenge the treatment, they're not going to treat. That's what's happening right now. You're seeing more and more practitioners, chiropractors, acupuncturists, therapists, medical doctors especially, refusing to even see automobile accident claimants on that very first visit. They don't want to deal with the hassle of an insurance company denial.
How do you deal then with the specific language of the statute as opposed to the legislative report, where it seems to limit disputes subject to objection to the amount of a charge or the correct fee or the procedure code? That seems to restrict this idea of a real party in interest only to those disputes and not to the denial of treatment.
Very good, and I agree with you, except if in fact that was the intent of the legislation, and if you read the committee report, it specifically mentions Wilson. And it specifically mentions Wilson in the context of standing and real party in interest. And again, if you just look at the statute itself, Mr. Moonmore probably has a very good point, because the statute really deals with the issue of how much versus no fee. But again, if you take a look at the committee report, which specifically mentions Wilson, that's where the reasoning process breaks down. And again, the reason that it is not in the statute itself is, as I understand 198, what the legislature is saying is we're not changing the statute. We're just trying to clarify what we always intended. This is a substantive right. Whether you make the threshold or not, you have an absolute substantive right to challenge the denial, whether it's for the amount of the fee or whether it's no fee. And it has nothing to do with making the threshold. When I read Wilson the first time,
Mr. Agena, is 431.10c 304 the denial statute? Do you know whether or not that statute contains provisions allowing insured, already says that an insured can pursue a denial?
I don't know if it's contained in 304. I can't remember anymore. I'm sorry. I don't know. Going back to the issue of Wilson, when I first read Wilson, I naturally jumped to the conclusion, being the plaintiff's attorney that I am, that this was wrongly decided. But again, as I look more and more at Wilson, I'm not sure that the Wilson court intended that that decision have this broad-reaching effect, which the insurance commissioner and all of the insurance carriers have adopted.
Well, despite what the Wilson plaintiff may have said, what if that plaintiff had needed further treatment with Dr. Robinson, needed a further additional surgery, even though it wasn't envisioned at that time? Because you were basically conceding that it was just, this court was correct in ruling that it was altruistic because that plaintiff had no further interest in treatment. But isn't it true that an insured actually doesn't know whether or not future treatment may become necessary from the same doctor?
No, I don't agree with that statement, Your Honor. Okay. If you're telling me that the claimant does not know whether or not she or he needs further treatment resulting from this accident, I don't agree with that. Because a lot of the medical doctors do, prognosis, and what they say is that you have stabilized. You don't need any more treatment because it's not going to make you better. Go home and do home exercise. That's very common, even after a surgical procedure. But going back to your question, if in fact the fact pattern was different and Wilson was in the court saying, hey, I need some more treatment, without the payment, I'm not going to get treated, query whether or not the decision would have been different. But again, as I understand the way the court functions, you're limited to the factual sequence of events presented to you. And again, in Wilson's case, it was, I have no interest in this at all, except to get Dr. Robinson paid. And again, just to clarify my understanding or my limited understanding, in the context of the legislation, what the legislature does is grants a substantive right. Despite that, any claimant, any party to a lawsuit still must meet the procedural requirements of standing and real party in interest. So again, this never came up here, and I don't know if one of the questions is this constitutional clash between the separation of powers. I don't think that's an issue right now. I don't anyway.
You raised the issue.
Oh, I shouldn't have. I knew I
could. Which is the legislature empowered to interpret our decisions? I mean, are they empowered to say that, well, this is, the court's function interpreting statutes, they were wrong, and we're going to interpret our own statute, and this is what we meant. I mean, is that possible?
I think the legislature can clarify what their intent of the statute was or is. I think they can do that. They have an absolute right, naturally, to pass laws granting substantive rights to people. and it's up to the court, as I understand it, to interpret and enforce it. One of the ways I understand the court to enforce laws, for example, is the issue of real party and interest. That's a procedural requirement that every single party must meet, just like standing, you know. So again, back to your question in terms of what the legislature can and cannot do, I believe that they can express, well, wait a minute, I read the decision, and maybe we wrote the legislation wrong, and therefore was wrongly interpreted, but our intent was this, which is what I think the Wilson, what I think the legislature did in response to Wilson. And I think that maybe it was a lack of legislative clarification, I don't know. You know, but again, as far as setting up the definition and the test for real party and interest and standing, I believe that's a judicial function, not a legislative one.
Is 198 retroactive?
I'm sorry?
Is 198 retroactive?
In the context of the amount of the fee, I don't think so. In the context of Wilson, there's nothing to retroact because, according to the committee report, there's no change in the statute. All we're doing is clarifying what we meant and who we are giving the substantive right to, whether or not they make the no-fault threshold or not. So
you
again,
agreed, though, it was retroactive at the trial level?
At the
trial level, you all agreed it was retroactive,
yes,
didn't you?
Yeah.
So you're changing your position?
When we talk about retroactivity, at the trial level, or I think you mean the DCC administrative hearing, you know, I had always taken the position, I thought, that that 198 was intended to clarify the issue of standing and real party and interest.
Didn't you also take the position that Wilson didn't apply to administrative hearings?
I think I took the position that Rule 17 didn't apply to the administrative hearing. At the ICA, I conceded that I was incorrect about that. There's a separate DCCA rule that says that if, in fact, there's no guidance, the DCCA can rely upon the rules of civil procedure. So at the ICA, I retracted that.
Mr. Aguena.
Yes, sir.
If the legislature has a committee report or legislative history that indicates in this particular, and this is a hypothetical, in this particular piece of legislation, we want to provide 1, 2, and 3. But when they actually draft the legislation, there's only 1 and 2. Does this court have the power to go and look at the committee reports and say, oh, the legislature intended to have a third item in the statute? So we're just going to read it in, even if the language is not in there. Do we? Does this court have that power?
The short answer is no. But the way that you get there and the way you have the authority to look at the committee report is whether or not there's an ambiguity in the statute. In the context of the argument from Liberty Mutual, there's an ambiguity because they're arguing that the legislation only intended to fix the amount of the fee. So again, that's the ambiguity that we're talking about, which gives the court the right and certainly the power to get back there and look at the committee report to see what the legislation was intended to do. So I think that's how you get there.
Now, when I look at the language of Act 198 itself, in the 1, 2, 3rd paragraph, I think it's the 3rd paragraph, it states the following. This act is intended to clarify the process to be followed in any billing adjustment or dispute where an insurer receives and does not dispute the treatment rendered, but finds the billing to exceed the permissible charges. That to me doesn't sound like they're describing the situation in Wilson. It sounds like they're describing the downcoding situation of orthopedic associates. And I note that in Act 198, the legislature only referenced orthopedic associates and not Wilson. So my question is, if it is your client's contention that the statute in question does deal with denials, where in the language of the statute do we find language that applies or extends the real party in interest status to denials?
You do not in the context of the statute and the amendment that you just read. I agree with you in the context of the wording of the statute itself. It dealt specifically with the amount of the fee as opposed to no fee. But again, if you take a look at the committee report, and I don't recall the committee report only talking about orthopedics. I understand that it did. There's a huge quote about orthopedics, which was a bigger part of the statute itself. But it also speaks to the issue of Wilson. I'm almost positive about that, and I don't have it right in front of me.
That's why I asked the hypothetical. They did speak of Wilson in the committee reports, but I'm wondering – whether the proposition that in the case of a denial, the patient is a real party in interest, did that proposition find its way into the language of the statute?
No. And the reason for it is that the statute already contemplates any no-fault claimant, whether they made the threshold or not, to be able to contest a denial. The report makes it very, very clear. We are not changing the statute regarding standing and real party in interest. All we're doing is clarifying what's there. That's what they're saying. That's why you don't see it in the legislation itself.
Well, Section 1 of Act 198, I don't know if Judge Chang is reading from Section 1, but it does say, and I hope I'm not repeating that, this act is intended to clarify the process. But it goes on to say this act is not intended to affect the merits of the amount billed or the amount owed under PIP. So doesn't that seem to indicate that the denial of benefits is not covered by this act?
The merits?
The merits. It goes on to say, is not intended to affect the merits of the amount billed or the amount owed under PIP.
I don't know what they mean by the merits of it. And when you talk about merits, to me, you're getting into the issue of necessary and related.
One of the Act only refers to orthopedic associates and doesn't mention Wilson.
Correct. And
so doesn't that limit the scope of the Act only to billing practices? Not the denial of benefits.
In terms of the scope of the act for amending the statute, yes, I believe that's correct. That part would be correct. But again, the reason why the statute itself is not changed is because there's nothing to change in the entire scheme of the No-Fault Act or the PIP Act. What the legislature is saying is that's already contained in the code and in the statute. We don't need to change the legislation itself.
You're saying that the legislative history has reinterpreted this act, including what was written before, aside from the amendments. And in reinterpreting it, they said the claimant is a real party in interest.
I think what they're saying is that the claimant has a substantive right, and our intent is to give the claimant real party in interest status. And yes, my answer
does
to your question.
Does that have anything to do with the amendment, though?
I don't know that the amendment itself, the actual amendment, underlined words in the statute, has anything to do with Wilson. And again, I don't want to be repeating myself about this. The reason there's no change in the statute anywhere is because the statute, according to the committee report, always intended to give claimants that right to challenge denials.
I may be missing something, but why are we even talking about 198? Could you have brought this under, Mr. Ma mentioned, 213?
Yes, except, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, you are correct. I could have done that, but down at the DCCA level, down at the arbitration level where you can always bring these claims as well, you can always ask for a separate arbitration proceeding as opposed to DCCA. Everybody took this expansive view of Wilson. If you made the threshold, and if in fact there is a denial, that's it. You don't have standing. You are not the real party in interest to challenge the claim. That was the way people looked at the Wilson case. So again, you are correct. But no matter what statute I brought it under, I would have lost, which is what happened at the DCCA level. I think I'm running up on my time. Are there any more questions? Just in closing, my best estimate is that this decision is probably going to affect about 80% of the auto claimants in the state of Hawaii in one way or another. I probably said things that don't make any sense to you. I probably said things inarticulately. I just don't want anybody to be hurt because of my ineptitude. Thank you. I really did enjoy being here.
Thank you, Mr. Aguena. How much time does Mr. Morma have left? All right.
And thank you again for allowing the parties to present our arguments. Honorable members of the court, I don't have anything further to add. I think it's been argued sufficiently. If there are questions, however, in the 3 minutes that I do have, I'd be happy to try to answer that. Otherwise,
if this was brought under 213 or 212, then you have no problem with granting the claimant as or recognizing the claimant as a real party in interest.
No, I do. Because under 431.10c2, if it's...
If Wilson was wrong in terms of saying that, well, you know, there's no real interest in maintaining this doctor-patient relationship, then based on what the legislature's found, would you agree that Wilson may be wrong, may have been wrong?
Correct. If you, Justice Sokoba, if you apply the legislative history across the board, and the intent is meant to affect not only the fee disputes under which the legislative history was enacted, but also to any treatment denial, then I would agree with that. But I again reiterate, and without, and forgive me for repeating myself, the legislature specifically enacted this under a specific statutory provision. It may, really makes no sense that the legislature intended this to apply.
Is there no statute that allows an insured to direct to pursue a denial?
There
is that under 314 or 304, or where is that?
An administrative action would be under 431.10c212.
Right.
Under 431.10c213, it's an arbitration proceeding. The Justice McKenna, the statutory provision you mentioned with Mr. Agena, 431.10c304, subsection 3, subsection B, does speak to the issuance of a denial. However, that does not indicate within that statutory provision that the claimant has a right to seek judicial review at that point.
So is it 314 that allows judicial review?
That would be my understanding. But under 304, it simply provides the mechanism by which the denial has to be issued, and in triplicate notice to the claimant as well as a copy to the provider. That is what is contained in 304.
Okay.
Thank you for any other questions. Thank you for the opportunity this morning.
Thank you.
We'll take this matter under advisement.